From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
What is wholly appropriate and what's not? Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. As President Trump prepares to visit the Middle East, his credibility as a foreign policy partner may have been compromised. Explaining Trump's conversation with Russian diplomats, his national security advisor repeated the same phrase over and over.
What was shared was wholly appropriate given the purpose of that conversation.
But the Washington Post and others are sticking by unnamed sources who claim the president's disclosure of closely held secrets created security problems. The president has tweeted that he has the absolute right to say what he wants about classified information. Meantime, he hosted the president of Turkey today, has a deadline involving the Iran nuclear deal tomorrow, and he's leaving Friday for the Middle East. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. On the eve of departure for his first trip overseas, President Trump is embroiled in another controversy. It's about those reports that he shared highly classified information with two high-ranking Russians. National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster gave reporters this explanation at a press briefing this morning.
What we don't do is discuss what is and what wasn't classified. What I will tell you is in the context of that discussion, what the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
The Associated Press reports that one foreign country says it was anything but routine. Josh Letterman covers foreign policy, national security, and the State Department for the AP. Hi, Josh. Good to have you with us.
Great to join you, Warren.
So what are you hearing and what is your organization hearing about the reaction of other countries?
Well, we know that other countries are looking very closely at this, some with alarm. As you mentioned, one European official told AP that that official's country might stop sharing intelligence with the U.S. as a result of this. We've also had a senior German lawmaker who is calling the disclosures by Trump, quote, highly worrying. So, this is obviously going to have to play out over the next several days as people evaluate just how bad this is. But certainly for, a lot of countries that have information sharing agreements with the U.S. that have stressed to the Trump administration in the past months, the importance of being careful with that information, this is going to make them perhaps give a second look to how much intelligence sharing they want to do.
The New York Times reports that the intelligence shared was, in fact, from Israel. Can you confirm that?
I cannot.
Okay.
That's certainly a possibility, given that the Israelis are one of the several intelligence services that closely follow developments in that region, including security threats from the Islamic State group. But that's not information that we've confirmed at this time.
All right, a lot of information coming in from a lot of different sources as this story develops. Here's what President Trump tweeted this morning. He said, as president, I wanted to share with Russia at an openly scheduled White House meeting, which I have the absolute right to do, facts pertaining to terrorism and airline flight safety. First question, does he have the absolute right to share this information, or is it potentially, at least, owned by somebody else?
Well, absolute right is probably not the term that I would use, but certainly, the rules about classification of information are based on an executive order, and, really the president is considered to have the ability to declassify information at will. In a way, he seems to be referring to the fact that the president, could say, okay, by disclosing this to someone, I have therefore made the decision that it's no longer classified and it's okay to disclose it, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't violate the arrangements that are in place as a result of these intelligence sharing agreements, and there could be serious repercussions, aside from whether or not he has the right to do it.
So there is some conversation that, in fact, if it came from another country, as you said, it could, in fact, not belong to the United States. Here again is General H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor today.
I should just make maybe the statement here that the president wasn't even aware, you know, of where this information came from. He wasn't briefed on the source or method of the information either. So I'm sorry, this is going to be the last question because we do have the president of Turkey coming. Thank you very much.
As you can hear, the reporters are shouting at him there for more information. We'll hear in a moment about the president of Turkey and what the president had to say, about our president had to say about that and how he associated it with the meeting with the Russians. But Josh Letterman, as a reporter at the State Department, how concerned do you think foreign governments are?
Well, I think they're very concerned, you know, not only because there had already been concerns that Trump perhaps wasn't totally in tune with the concerns and seriousness with which classified information and intelligence is usually treated, but also because of the place that this information ended up, which is with the Russian government, you know, a U.S. longtime adversary that a lot of other countries are worried about. So I think that it's going to, you know, continue to raise a lot of those concerns about, you know, the president's judgment in deciding, you know, what type of information should be shared with a country like Russia.
Are Republicans raising this issues as well as Democrats and others?
Certainly. We've seen a number of prominent Republicans today say that they have, you know, serious concerns about what's happened. Obviously, the Democrats are shouting a lot louder, as they typically do about a Republican president. But there have been bipartisan concerns about, you know, if not the fact that the information was disclosed, at least how this whole situation has unfolded, and the fact that the president seemed to make the decision on the spot in an Oval Office meeting with the Russians, as opposed to through some type of deliberative process. Yes, let's make a decision to do it. It seemed more like it was on the fly.
And some Democrats, particularly Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon, are saying that this just makes it clearer than ever that we need a special counsel or a special prosecutor or some kind to look into the sharing of this kind of information with a hostile power. That's how he describes Russia. So much more to come. Josh Letterman, great to have you on our program, and thanks as always for being with us.
Great to be here.
Report from the State Department for the Associated Press. Now, in a moment, we'll hear more about foreign affairs in the early days of the Trump administration, including this meeting he had today with President Erdogan of Turkey. We'll go on from there and talk more about his trip to the Middle East coming up starting on Friday. This is To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. At this morning's press briefing, the National Security Advisor, General H.R. McMaster, said it's not the president's remarks to Russian officials that have damaging consequences, but leaks to the press.
I think national security is put at risk by this leak and by leaks like this. And there are, you know, there are a number of instances where this has occurred. And I think it's important to investigate these sort of things and to make sure that we have trusted organizations across our government that allows for the free sharing of information and collaboration.
Neda Rock-Bakos is a former CIA analyst. She's now a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is a centrist think tank. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
What do you say to the relative danger of the president saying these things and other people leaking them?
I mean, the president has a wide berth to be able to talk about classified information, even in a public forum. So the question isn't a legal question necessarily. It's really more about the fact that this was a partner's information that was not releasable yet to any other governments. So in order to protect that relationship and relationships with other foreign intel agencies going forward, we needed to make sure we had permission to share that, especially with a country like Russia, who is typically considered to be an adversary for most.
How do you feel when the National Security Advisor says that the president wasn't briefed on the source of the information?
That, to me, if true, means that there's a breakdown in the process. The president needs to understand the context of the information that he is reviewing, especially given the fact that if this was about the laptop ban, this has wide-reaching implications across the airline industry, the veracity of that information is very important for the president to understand if he's going to be making sweeping changes such as banning laptops to and from Europe.
Okay, that's the first time we've heard on this program about the laptop ban. When Mr. Trump tweeted, he mentioned that he wanted Russia to greatly step up their fight against ISIS and terrorism. That had to do with the laptop bans. Explain it.
Well, according to all the reporting that we're seeing so far, the laptop ban, the threats is stemming from ISIS. And Washington Post had reported yesterday that part of that discussion with Russia was about ISIS and the threat from ISIS in addition to the laptop ban. So protecting that source in particular is extremely important for the United States because we need to keep that stream open so that we understand what the threats are to the homeland.
And the laptop ban, the suggestion is that that ISIS might be developing some sort of bomb that people could take on planes in their laptops. And that's caused a lot of trouble from people who say they want to hold onto their laptops and not put them in their luggage.
Right. And we've seen this from terrorist organizations looking to modify and outmaneuver any securities that we put in place. So this wasn't a complete surprise that they're arriving at this point in 2017. But at the same time, they have to take this seriously. And that goes back to how confident is the intel community in this information? And if they're that confident in it, the president needs to understand that context, which means the source and method of this should have been shared with him.
If, as the New York Times is reporting, Israel was the original source of this information and, as we've heard, essentially owned it and the president hadn't had permission as yet to give it out, what are the intelligence implications of that?
Well, the intelligence implications, Israel said in this New York Times article that they have confidence that they will continue to share information with the United States, but you know that their intelligence agency itself, just like every other intelligence agency, does not want their information splashed across the front page and or told to somebody who it's not releasable to. So I think they're going to be more reticent to do that, rightfully so. And I think this has ripple effect with other intelligence agencies. We saw from Associated Press reporting that the Europeans are now being more cautious, possibly going forward and sharing information with us, and rightfully so.
Again, Neda Bakos is a former CIA analyst and now at the Foreign Policy Research Institute at the White House today. The president met with the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and he made reference to this controversy over classified information.
Well, we had a very, very successful meeting with the foreign minister of Russia. Our fight is against ISIS. As General McMaster said, I thought he said, and I know he feels, that we had actually a great meeting with the foreign minister. So we're going to have a lot of great success over the next coming years, and we want to get as many to help fight terrorism as possible. And that's one of the beautiful things that's happening with Turkey. The relationship that we have together will be unbeatable. So thank you all very much.
President Erdogan sitting next to the president as he made those comments. Robin Wright is a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center. She's also a contributing writer to The New Yorker. Good to have you back on our show.
Always great to be with you, Warren.
As the president gets ready to go to the Middle East, which you have covered for so many years, what do you make of all this?
Well, this is a really tough time for him to be leaving the country, but I'm sure it's going to be a bit of a reprieve getting away from the tensions of Washington, which is consumed with not just this latest issue, but a bombshell a day or a bombshell a week that has unsettled the capital of this country profoundly. It's clear that this is an ambitious trip. The irony is that another president, in the midst of a domestic crisis, went to the Middle East, went to Saudi Arabia and Israel as well, but it didn't help him either, and that was Richard Nixon in 1974, and 2 months later, he was forced to resign.
I don't want to make too many historical parallels, but that is certainly an interesting one. You say that he's leaving behind the controversy, but it seems to me, with regard to the concern of foreign countries, he's walking into it as well. Particularly, he's going to Saudi Arabia first, but then he's going to Israel. And we're now hearing that Israel was the source of the information that he unwittingly revealed.
Well, Israel needs the United States more than the United States needs Israel, frankly. And I expect that intelligence exchange to continue. Well, the big question, as mentioned earlier, is to what degree, how much intelligence is provided, at what stage. And there may be reluctance, but I think that there is a very solid intelligence relationship between the United States and its closest ally in the Middle East. And I think that will continue, particularly because they share a concern about growing extremism in the region. And I think this Israeli government feels more confidence in the Trump administration than it did in the Obama administration in terms of its security needs.
He's going first to Saudi Arabia. You mentioned that Richard Nixon went there as well. But this is this president's first trip abroad. What's the significance of that? Is Saudi Arabia all that important as an ally to the United States?
Saudi Arabia is a second-tier ally at best, given its own political practices, its human rights violations, which the State Department chronicled in its annual report released in March. But the Saudis, according to the White House, reached out very early after the election to encourage a visit. And the president is intent on building this new coalition that will center on the very conservative sheikhdoms, the six sheikhdoms in the Persian Gulf, as well as the conservative governments in Jordan and Egypt. And they are all expected to meet in Riyadh. And the Agence France-Presse has just reported that the president will give a speech on Islam in Saudi Arabia, which is the birthplace of Islam. And one could ask, what could possibly go wrong?
You have quoted in the New Yorker magazine some of the things that the president said during the campaign about Saudi Arabia and how the United States is backing the kingdom at tremendous expense and getting nothing for it. Tell us a bit more about what he said.
Well, during the campaign, the president tweeted several times and spoke at public rallies about the fact that the United States had gotten very little for all it had done for Saudi Arabia. He was very critical of Hillary, for example, for her ties to the kingdom. And so the whole tenor of his remarks about Saudi Arabia, noting that they were responsible or had links to the 9/11 attacks because the majority of the hijackers, the bombers, were Saudi citizens. So it's a real flip-flop when it comes to the kind of language he used about the kingdom during the campaign, and now making this the very first stop as president on a foreign trip.
Robin Wright, the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Woodrow Wilson Center, and the New Yorker magazine. Another of the things that you quoted is that he said that not only has Saudi Arabia given vast amounts of money to the Clinton Foundation, but that they want women as slaves and to kill gays. Mohammed Bazzi is a Lebanese-American journalist. He's a former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday and currently a journalism professor at New York University. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Given what we know about Saudi Arabia and its ongoing relationship with the United States, do you think the Saudis will remember that kind of a comment as the president visits?
Well, they certainly don't seem to be making any public mention of these kinds of comments. The Saudis have been ecstatic that Trump decided to visit Saudi as his first stop on his first foreign visit. There's been headlines about the visit in the Saudi press almost every day. As soon as the White House announced this last week, one of the major Saudi newspapers ran a graphic that showed that listed every U.S. president's first visit going back to Teddy Roosevelt. And just to drive home the point of how important it was that Saudi is first. And they've been campaigning almost with this idea that they're going to be the conduit between the Trump administration and the Arab and the Muslim world. There are these three summits set for this weekend. One is between the Saudi leadership and Trump. One is between the Gulf Cooperation Council leadership and Trump. And then this large-scale summit between Arab and Muslim world leaders and Trump. And so the Saudi leadership is highlighting all of this and trying really to get back to a point in their relationship with the U.S. that they feel they lost this advantage under President Obama, that they lost their nexus, so to speak, their nexus in the Arab and Muslim world, and they feel they can get that back under Trump.
Robin Wright, back to you. You've spent a lot of time writing about Iran and visiting that country. And, of course, Saudi Arabia and Iran are very much at odds. How do you think this trip is going to be perceived there?
Well, one of the missions on the Trump trip is to create a coalition that will confront ISIS, but also confront Iran. It is very much a coalition of Sunni leaders. And, of course, Iran is the world's preeminent or largest Shiite or predominantly Shiite country. And so I think this is going to be very worrisome. Ironically, the president leaves Washington on the same day that Iranians go to the polls to elect a president. And President Rouhani, who was the interlocutor with the United States on the nuclear deal, faces a lot of pressure from a very conservative candidate who is also rumored to be a candidate to be the next supreme leader. And so this is not going, you know, the timing doesn't work very well for the very people that the United States would rather see in power in Iran.
So, Mohammed Bazzi, we have then visits to all of the original Abrahamic religion source sites, if that's the appropriate way to say it, and the idea that somehow this president can unite all three of those elements, even though one of them, as we just heard, of course, is very much divided. What do you think of his chances of achieving that?
I think the chances of that are almost zero, and you see it just by the fact that, well, certainly Trump won't be able to actually go to Mecca or Medina, the two holy cities of Islam, because non-Muslims are not allowed, certainly in Mecca they're not allowed. And this idea of the speech that he's planning to give in Saudi Arabia about Islam, the potential for things to go wrong with that, and the potential for mishaps is extraordinary. So on the symbolic level, even, it's going to be really difficult for these elements to gel together.
And with regard to his meeting today with President Erdogan, how tense do you think that was, given the fact that the United States has been supportive of Kurds who are enemies, according to Erdogan, of Turkey?
We had a lot of indications that at least a week ago, before the Trump administration announced publicly that it would be arming the Kurdish rebels in Syria, that Erdogan would try to use the meeting to talk Trump out of that step, that he would try to get Trump to change course a bit and hold back on support of the Kurds in Syria. So it's likely a very tense meeting. We didn't see a lot of tension in their public statements, but they made their public statements today before they had the really substantial talks. And we saw almost some conciliatory statements in the public portion, at least in the early statements before the lunch. There was a statement by President Trump, something along the lines of, "We assure Turkey of our support to counter the terrorism of ISIS and the PKK."
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we need to go to a break, and I want to thank Neda Bakos at the Foreign Policy Research Institute for being with us. We're going to continue this conversation with our current guests, and we'll also add others as we go forward on To the Point from PRI. Well, we're only back with To the Point. Once again, President Trump in the midst of another controversy, this time about his release of information that apparently belonged to another country, very possibly Israel, according to the New York Times, in such a way as to endanger security and his position as a willing partner to share with other countries that kind of information. One of the places, again, that he's going is Saudi Arabia. That's the first place he's going, and we've heard how much the Saudis are welcoming that. Before he leaves, he has a document to sign having to do with the nuclear agreement with Iran. Here's what he said back in April, talking about the Iran nuclear deal.
It was a terrible agreement. It shouldn't have been signed. It shouldn't have been negotiated the way it was negotiated. I'm all for agreements, but that was a bad one, as bad as I've ever seen negotiated. They are not living up to the spirit of the agreement.
Nagar Mortazavi is an Iranian journalist and commentator. She's now based in Washington, D.C., worked as a TV host for The Voice of American Persian. Good to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is it that the president has to do, according to the agreement, before he leaves for the Middle East?
So they have to, he has to still review the sanctions part of the Iran deal and see if that's going to continue as it was after President Obama took off from office, or if the administration is going to make any changes. I don't think they are going to make any specific changes to it, but their rhetoric has always been very different from the Obama team. So it's still up to see until the very last minute.
So this is something, as I understand it, they have to do every 3 months. President Obama did it, as you said, before he left office. Now it is President Trump's turn. But he says Iran is not living up to the spirit of the agreement. What's he talking about?
So I guess the administration is focusing a lot on the only concrete thing we can think of right now is the missile test that Iran has conducted recently. It was definitely provocative on the hardliner side. That's even something the Iranian president, Rouhani, the moderate president, has mentioned as detrimental to the deal. But Iranians also do persist that it is not legally against what the nuclear deal was. And that's why I think President Trump is focusing more on the spirit. But when you focus on the Iranian side also, they're saying the same exact thing, that it's the United States who is not accountable to the spirit of the nuclear deal and is doing, as far as Congress and the administration goes, is taking steps to try to derail it.
Taking steps to try to derail it, and yet willing to sign, we think, this agreement. So what evidence is there for what the Iranians are saying about the Americans violating the spirit?
Well, right now there's new sanctions being discussed in Congress. It's been going on for a while. The Congress is focusing on the sanctions pertaining to the missile test, the missile program of Iran. But just today we had Wendy Sherman, who was the top U.S. negotiator, saying that these new sanctions, if they do pass in Congress, are going to be detrimental, again, to the spirit of the deal because it's controversial. And she even called it not really helpful to what the U.S. and Iran standing is right now. So, what both sides, what they're doing is they're really going around all these different avenues that they have without really touching the actual agreement, which I think is telling as far as how successful and how solid this international agreement, the nuclear deal, was, that none of the two sides, the hardliners at least, have been able to derail it yet.
You mentioned the missile test and said that was a provocative act by the hardliners. Are they attempting to have an impact on the election to be held later this week, which I understand they are opposed to the current president, Hassan Rouhani, who, of course, negotiated the nuclear deal?
Of course. So the hardliners have Ebrahim Raisi. He is a hardline figure that is known to be supported by the Supreme Leader, although not publicly. And he's not a very strong candidate when he's compared to President Rouhani, who's also a sitting president, which gives him even more advantage in Iran. So the hardliners have been doing everything they can, domestic and international, to try to basically undermine President Rouhani. And one of his main achievements was this nuclear deal, was a negotiations with Europe and with America, and that's something that the hardliners have been trying. When it was going on, they tried to derail it all along, and now that it's successful, they have been trying everything in their power to try to stop it from continuing, and they haven't succeeded yet. But it's definitely, the election is something that is on every hardliner's mind.
So, Robin Wright, back to you at the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Woodrow Wilson Center, and the New Yorker magazine. The deal is controversial in both countries. How likely do you think it is that the Congress, with this president, can in some way roll it back?
I think it'd be very hard to roll the deal back, but they can certainly put increasing pressure on Iran on other issues, whether it's over the missile test, over human rights abuses, over support for terrorism. Iran is still considered to be the foremost state supporter of extremist movements in the region. And that, of course, erodes the broader picture of, can you make any progress with Iranians on, for example, settling Syria or diffusing tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia? It changes the atmospherics profoundly. And I do think that Congress is in the mood right now for new sanctions, and I think the Trump administration would welcome it. It has talked very openly about negatively about the balance of power having shifted under Obama toward the Iranians. I'm not sure that's true, but that's the way it's perceived by this administration. And that's one of the reasons that the president has opted to go to Saudi Arabia first and to meet not only with the king, but the six leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and the Jordanian and Egyptian leaders. This is the Sunni alliance that is most opposed and most active against Iran.
Nagar Modazavi, we heard obviously that from you that the leadership is divided in Iran. What about the people of Iran? How much do they care about this balance of power and the rivalry with the Sunni countries, particularly Saudi Arabia?
Well, the public is also divided, just like the leadership. But right now, currently, the moderates or the current administration of the team of President Rouhani has the upper hand, has had the support of the majority in the past election, and polls show that he has the support of the majority of the public in the current election. The average Iranian honestly doesn't care much about the Sunni-Shia rivalry. There's even Iranian Sunnis living in Iran, some of which have entered the President Rouhani's administration, actually, interestingly. But just reducing tensions with the world, reducing tensions with the West, with America, and specifically with Iran's neighbors in the region has been something that the Iranian public has wanted, because they have seen the consequences of the tension, of the proxy wars, of, you know, just the economic and the social and the political impacts on the everyday life of the Iranians, and also considering that these proxy wars are not far away from the Iranian public's physical, you know, like the U.S. that's ocean away, the U.S. public from these wars, the Iranians, it's right next door to where they actually live. So it's something that's on the Iranians' mind, and I think the majority, what they want from the president and the administration is to reduce these tensions in the region and with the world powers, and that's something President Rouhani had been promising and is still insisting on, that he's going to even improve their relations. So we'll have to see if he wins and how much power he has to actually do reduce these tensions.
Mohammed Bazzi, back to you, our Lebanese-American journalist, former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday, now a journalism professor at New York University. How accurately do we in the United States view what's going on in the Middle East when it is so complex and divided in so many different ways?
Well, I don't think we see it very accurately. I think we see attempts, certainly in the press, to explain it, but it is very complex and it is very multi-layered, and sometimes it's multiple elements taking place at once, like the Saudi-Iranian rivalry. There is a Sunni-Shia dimension to it, but there's also a very strong political dimension to it, in that these are the two strongest political powers in the region, and they're often competing politically in different places, and so the proxy wars between them are a political conflict, and then sectarianism begins to underlie that political conflict, and they both take steps, they both take actions that promote sectarianism, and then sectarianism becomes this cycle that's very difficult to break.
So, Robin, right, it's a political issue here in this country as well, apparently simplified for public consumption.
phrase that again?
It seems to me that the whole situation in the Middle East is, because it has such political connotations here in this country, is often simplified in the interests of those political interests that are competing for one another, whether it's the Democrats and Republicans or others who disagree.
Everything in Washington is politicized. I've lived in this town now for a quarter century, and I've never seen anything like it, and it gets worse by the day. The Middle East, of course, is the part of the world that is both most volatile and resonates probably most politically among people in Washington because of various competing interest groups. It will be a tough trip for the president, and trying to with his very ambitious agenda, he wants to start a new peace process. He wants to build this coalition. He's going to the birthplace of Jesus. He's going to the birthplace in Bethlehem. He's going to the birthplace of Islam in Saudi Arabia. And then he goes, to top it all off, to the Vatican, where he's been in a kind of Twitter feud with the Pope over issues of immigration and building walls and so forth. So it's the trip itself is so grandiose in its ambitions and so sweeping that it's going to be very hard to see how he gets all he wants. There may be some good optics, but can he produce long-term results? And I think that's a question that troubles everyone in Washington and increasingly Republicans, too.
Nagar Modarzavi, I know you need to leave us. Again, our Iranian journalist now based in Washington. Anything you'd like to add to what we've heard?
No, I pretty much agree with what the other experts are saying. It's just that when from a Muslim and an Iranian viewpoint, when you see Trump traveling as to presumably the birthplace of Islam, I don't think many Muslims buy that. He's not really traveling to the birthplace of Islam when I talk to people in the Middle East asking. It's mostly going to the political center of the Saudi Arabia, and it's definitely seen as a political move. It's seen as even a financial/political move from the administration, and considering the travel ban against the Muslims, considering Trump's rhetoric against the Muslims during the campaign, after the campaign, this even includes Muslim Americans. I don't think that part of the advertisement of the trip is going to have much standing when it comes to the Muslim world, especially in the Middle East.
Nagar Modarzavi, formerly a TV host for Voice of America Persia. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mohammed Bazzi, back to you. What about Jared Kushner and his involvement, particularly with Saudi Arabia? He, of course, being Jewish.
So we've seen reports lately that Kushner has been a key part of organizing President Trump's trip to Saudi, and it seems like he's developed a personal relationship with the deputy crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. He's the son of the king. He's also the defense minister, and he has the economic portfolio. In many ways, he's the Kushner of the Saudi royal family in the multiple portfolios he handles, and also in his youth. And little political experience. So the two seem to have bonded. They've played a major role in organizing this visit to Saudi. Kushner also has the wider Middle East portfolio in the Trump administration, and he's going to play a central role in the visit to Israel. He's charged with restarting the Middle East peace process. So he has a grand portfolio. The fact that he's Jewish, I don't think, bothers the Saudis very much. Saudi, we've seen reports over the past few years of some clandestine meetings between Saudi officials and Israeli officials in different parts of Europe. And there's definitely a Saudi-Israeli interest in containing Iran, in limiting Iran, and in also pushing the Trump administration to its natural stance against Iran. So that's a place where Saudi Arabia and Israel will have a lot of common ground.
Robin Wright, back to you. Who besides Mr. Kushner do you think the president is listening to? And now that we've had this long conversation about the trip upcoming and the various places that are being visited, which you've described as very grandiose in its objectives and its vision, Do you find a coherent foreign policy? Can you identify long term what it is that the Trump administration wants to achieve?
Well, its policy review is not over yet. This is a process that often takes a president up to 6 months to come up with a formal document that defines foreign policy and their objectives. With this president, it's very hard to see what the long-term goals are. He seems to kind of flip-flop. He criticized China during the campaign and then welcomed President Xi as, you know, almost like a bosom buddy. We're seeing how he's flip-flop with Saudi Arabia. When it comes to who he's listening to, the impression in Washington is always that he kind of reflects the last person he spoke to. He does have a number of voices talking to him. There was hope, of course, that after H.R. McMaster came in as National Security Advisor, there'd be a bit more stability than there was under Michael Flynn in that very turbulent three-week period. But the reality is that H.R. McMaster is also facing his own pressures in Washington, and he's finding it pretty difficult to navigate an unstable White House that is under siege on a number of different fronts, and to kind of direct the president's vision. There are a number of reports about the exchange between the two men as the H.R. McMaster is trying to explain some foreign policy issues, and Trump feels like he's being lectured to. And so there are questions already about will H.R. McMaster last the entire 4 years, and at what point does he also face the jeopardy of being fired?
He, of course, still serving as a general. We always use that term in introducing him, and it is not because he's a retired general, but because he's in the active military. So that's an interesting situation for him because, obviously, he's working for the commander-in-chief.
That's right. And in many ways, when asked to do that job, he would almost have to accept it or face the prospect of retiring. You do take the orders of the commander-in-chief. And he is a very well-experienced man, widely respected in Washington. The current White House does have a lot of military people staffing the National Security Council, and that's always been a bit of a concern, not okay. The kind of balance as in the past.
Robin Wright, always good to have you, senior fellow, U.S. Institute of Peace in the Woodrow Wilson Center and The New Yorker magazine, contributing writer Mohammed Bazzi, formerly Middle East Bureau Chief at Newsday, now professor of journalism at New York University. Thanks to you both. Thanks to our other guests as well. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. To Washington, of course, and much of the world now is abuzz with reports that President Trump shared classified information with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and the Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The Oval Office conversation, once again, has gone global. So what about Moscow? Is it a story there? Alec Alun is a reporter for The Guardian. He joins us from Moscow. Good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be with you.
Nothing else, it seems, is being discussed in Washington, at least for the moment. What about Moscow?
Yeah, and Moscow has taken note that nothing else is being discussed and is quite disgusted with that fact. I heard from the foreign ministry this morning. They later said in a statement that this news about Trump revealing classified information to Foreign Minister Lavrov and Ambassador Kislyak was a pre-planned media campaign, a hit piece on Russia, was how the foreign ministry spokeswoman framed it. She said that the U.S. media had been planning since last week's meeting to put out some sort of allegedly sensational news, and then she said that there was plans to use the photograph of Trump meeting with Lavrov and Kislyak to illustrate that news. That photograph, of course, already came out, and it caused a scandal after it was realized that Russian media had been allowed into the meeting, but U.S. media had not. Also, we had Vladimir Putin's spokesman saying today that these allegations were nonsense and that he didn't even see it fit to comment or confirm or deny them. Just as usual, Moscow reacting angrily and with disgust to the order of the day in Washington.
It kind of cuts the knees off, or cuts off at the knees, the idea of a media conspiracy when the photo, in fact, was taken by TASS and released by TASS, and Americans weren't even allowed in.
Yeah, the foreign ministry spokeswoman was claiming that the foreign ministry had gotten that photo released deliberately to take the wind out of the sails of this American media conspiracy. But you have to realize that these Russian claims, I mean, the conspiracy theories are a big part of a lot of what Russia says about relations with the U.S., relations with Syria, and they don't seem to be getting tired of them anytime soon.
Here's something that the Russian foreign ministry spokesman posted on Facebook. We know President Trump is at war with the media. He's the Russian spokeswoman said, "Guys, have you been reading American newspapers again? You shouldn't read them. You can put them to various uses, but you shouldn't read them. Lately, it's become not only harmful but dangerous." Too interesting what those foreign other uses might be for American newspapers, but I take it that the like the White House, the Russians use the media as they please.
Well, if you're referring to the U.S. media, the Kremlin does like to react, and the foreign ministry likes to react to the American media. They may strike a very angry tone, but I think that deep down inside, they're very pleased that Russia is at the top of the U.S. news cycle so often. I think that this latest story really plays into their hands. We have Foreign Minister Lavrov, the ambassador, meeting personally with Trump. They're showing that Russia is an important international player, that Russia is the key to any solution in the Syrian conflict, that Russia is speaking with the leader of the free world. So, I mean, these images and these stories are very important for Moscow, because the driving principle of Putin's foreign policy in recent years has really been to put Russia back on the world scene, make it an important player, make it the kind of country that other countries like the United States, like countries in Europe, have to come to and speak with to solve international issues.
So they can say they're disgusted, but this is pretty good public relations.
Absolutely.
What about Russia-U.S. relations after all of this, and the situation in Syria, the chemical attack and so on that's gotten an awful lot of attention here? Is the relationship thawing, do you think, as President Obama hoped it would, and as President Trump seems to be showing in every way that he can that it will?
It's been a real roller coaster, and it changes so fast it's almost hard to keep up with. Last month, of course, the U.S. cruise missile strikes on the Syrian air base in response to the chemical attacks in Khan Sheikhoun were taken very negatively in Moscow. Moscow told off Washington several times for that, said that the United States could not be trusted. And that was certainly a kind of reality check for the relations, because before that, all we had really had were vague statements from Trump, vague statements from Putin, praising each other, but not really giving any sort of concrete idea of how the two countries were actually going to work together, what they were going to achieve. With the cruise missile strikes, we saw highlighted again how U.S. and Russian interests often don't overlap. And no matter how much goodwill there is between Trump and Putin personally, the interests are not necessarily going to overlap. After the cruise missile strikes, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, came to Moscow. I was at that press conference, and he put on a good face and talked about wanting to restart dialogue with Moscow. But after he spoke, Sergei Lavrov came on and said that, basically pointed out a lot of the the issues that were still dividing the two countries. First and foremost, their vision for Syria, their vision for what the future of Bashar al-Assad might be. Those are remain issues on which the two countries are on totally opposite sides of the picture. And right now, it's hard to say where exactly the relationship is at. And we keep coming back to Syria, obviously. Trump and Putin have both talked about the need for establishing safe zones in Syria. And the Russian brokered agreement earlier this month in Kazakhstan between the Syrian government and opposition and Iran and Turkey about the creation of safe zones and the establishment of a ceasefire, that really seemed to mirror Trump's rhetoric about what should happen in Syria. But then we saw that that was also put on hold because the United States had some reservations. It wasn't clear how the safe zones were going to be enforced. It wasn't clear if the U.S. coalition was going to be allowed inside of them or not, inside what areas. Also, the Syrian opposition was concerned because Iran was going to be a party to the safe zones.
Very quickly, we're just about out of time, but how do the Russians feel about the first trip by the president of the United States being to Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think they can't be happy about it because I haven't seen much, but I think they can't be happy about it because Moscow has always allied itself
with Iran,
the other side of the Middle East, really, with Iran especially. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Alec Loon, it's always good to have you with us again with The Guardian based in Moscow. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.